This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, it's Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams, episode number 62, featuring Doc Coyle, guitarist for Bad Wolves, and you have the X-Man podcast. You're a fellow podcaster, basketball fan, active on social media, but in a very measured way, because I know today we want to talk about both your love for basketball and dealing with social and political issues. And thank you for using the pro mic. I know we talked about it just before we got on.
Sure, no problem.
It's really funny to me. I interview so many people, and I can tell you, especially with singers, how they'll do an interview on their webcam, and I'm like, but you're a singer. Like, don't you have a mic now? Someone has even like a, it's so funny, you know? But I like to make sure everybody sounds good, right?
Absolutely.
Now, obviously, you got back to touring with Papa Roach and Hollywood Undead recently and getting shaking the rafters again with lots of loud sounds. But also, since you're a big basketball fan, what was the first, actually, what was the first time you went back to a concert, and when was the first time you went back to a basketball game? During all this craziness.
Good question. What was the first show I went back to? I want to say, I don't know if it was the first show, but I feel like it was like the first show I actually went to was at just a bar. It was like a bar show. Friends band, you know, rock band was playing, but like the first like big show was the Megadeth, Lamb of God, Trivium, Hatebreed show. And I was down at Five Points in Orange County, and it was, man, what great energy, man. People were so excited. It was just, it was a great kind of celebratory, kind of sigh of relief kind of moment. I mean, the second I could go out and go to shows, I was trying to get to everything I could. I figured, I was like, you know what? I'm vaccinated, pretty much done what you can do. And we got to get back to doing stuff because, you know, that stuff, even there's the element of me playing and performing and kind of how that is good for my mental health and just getting that kind of as an exercise is very kind of vital for me in my life. But going to shows and having that cathartic experience as a viewer and also it's the connective tissue, I think, of our scene. You know, it's metal and rock exist because of the live environment and how we connect with each other and kind of getting that full kind of almost quasi-religious experience of enjoying something together. It's really important.
And then for basketball now, for you, you're a big sports fan. So what was the first game and what was that like?
So what game did I go? so I have a friend who, name is Becky, who works, I think, back around, so I'm probably pronouncing your last name wrong. I'm sorry, Becky, works for Harman, and they have AKG and a bunch of JBL, and so they sponsor the band, and she hits me up. She goes, hey, you want to go to any games? And she sent me a list of, like, basketball games and stuff at and hockey games at the Staples Center, now the Crypto.com arena. And so I went to go see the Lakers play. Who did they play? They played the Sacramento Kings. So me and three other buddies went. Great seats. It was amazing. Sorry, that's my dog.
No, it's okay.
Barking. Hopefully she'll stop barking in a second.
How long have you been a basketball fan? Did you play as a kid? Have you played?
Yeah,
since
I
then?
Played in. The funny thing is, I didn't start playing till I was almost in high school. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got a late start, but I just took to it and I loved it. So I started playing like right kind of around eighth grade, going to ninth grade. And I didn't play in ninth grade, but I played so much I got good enough that by the time I was a sophomore, I started playing on my high school team. And then halfway through that year, I got on the varsity team, and I really loved it. But I feel like if I would have started early, I probably would have been really good. But because I'm 6'2", it's pretty athletic, could shoot. But a lot of those instincts, that if you don't develop them at a younger age, it just you're just slightly a step behind with some of the, you know, the instincts, you know, the things that kind of come second nature. But I was what they call a gym rat. You know, I just lived in the gym. Playing basketball is probably my favorite thing about high school, and played as much as I could in the intervening years since. But I've had a lot of back injuries and just a lot of problems, so it's been hard to really play for the last like 5 years or so, which sucks because I love it. So maybe one day I'll get back in shape and be able to handle it. But it's just, if it's not a back, it's a knee. It's always something. Neck. Ankles. Dude,
I'm dealing with a torn meniscus right now. I've been doing some PT. I got to get into that surgery.
Oh no!
I'm like, I don't even know how I did it. I guess it's just age. You know, I'd like to say it was something romantic and dramatic, like, you know, I was playing a game or like I was doing something risky. I was like, no, just, you know, got to go get it done. But I imagine for you, the tricky part is if you have an injury in sports that affects your playing on stage because you're moving around a lot. So it's tricky. You have two different things you love to do that require a lot of physical energy and dexterity.
Yeah. And all of that has affected, my back and all that stuff that, you know, and I bartended too for like almost 10 years, and that was pretty physically taxing well. So it's, it sucks when sometimes your physical limitations inhibit your ability to do the things you love to do. But luckily I had back surgery. I've, you know, learned a lot more about my body and core strength and things like that, so that I can at least play. You know, I did the last tour and physically held up really well. You know, trying to cross my fingers.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because you know those things when you're younger, it's like people say, just enjoy it when you're young because you're going to get older and like little things start happening. And it's, you can, I mean, look, Mick Jagger's still out there. I mean, he's like around 80, he's like 80s now, right? I mean, it's incredible. I mean, as a kid, I played Little League. I did that for 3 summers, and I tried soccer, but I did not like getting kicked in the shins all the time. That was just not, I was a scrawny kid, so that was really not going to work for me. But it's interesting. What is it about basketball that lured you in? Because I was thinking about, I enjoy watching it. Like, I don't watch sports, but every time I go to a bar with my girlfriend, she's like, you're watching a game. Like, I end up looking at whatever's on the TV. And basketball to me feels like it's got the energy. It's not as violent as hockey or football, but it's not as mellow as, just sort of, actually, there's an aggression, but there's a gracefulness to it to me. What lured you into it?
I mean, I think there's the obvious connection between being a fan of it and watching it. You know, I grew up during the era of Michael Jordan and, you know, those Knicks teams from the early 90s, and you want to emulate the things you see. And to me, the one thing about that sport, probably more than any other sport, is the athletes kind of resemble superheroes more than any other sport. They're the most physically unique, right? If you saw a really top level Hall of Fame baseball player, they still look like a normal guy. Basketball players don't look normal. They're 6'8". They're 260 pounds. Like, they're, you know, and it's, even if you have like a really jacked football player, they're covered in stuff, right? So you don't really see, but you kind of see these kind of otherworldly physiques, and they fly through the air. You know, it's really kind of unique in that regard. And I think from a playing standpoint, one thing that's so appealing about it is, if it's just you playing by yourself, you can practice and you can play. If it's you and one other person, you can play one-on-one. If it's you and three people, you can play 21. It's a, you know, it's a very adaptable game that you can get something out of it no matter who's around you. So you have a little more control over that, right? It's hard to play, you know, you can't play football by yourself. You can't, you know, baseball is a little tough, you know, unless you're at the batting cage. So there's something about that probably is a real key to why it's kind of the predominant urban sport, you know, of that accessibility, you know, and you don't need a lot. You just need a ball and a hoop. It's not, you know, you hear about how expensive it is if your kid plays hockey, for all the gear and shuttling them to games and all that stuff, or sports like tennis where you need this access, and so it just has that low barrier of entry. And I think all sports are inherently like therapeutic. You know, it's a place where you can kind of shut off the thinking mind and you can just be and react. And there's something about that when you're done playing, you feel, you know, and you're exhausted and you like, you can't really get that out anywhere else. And like I said, there is, it's very physical. You're bumping into people, you're fighting for rebounds. You're, you know, there's that kind of gladiator element. I think that kind of speaks to all of us that is very gratifying.
Now you're from New Jersey originally, but you're living in LA. So you're still rooting for the hometown, or do you like, you're more of a...
I'm a Knicks fan. You know, I've always been a Knicks fan, despite the New Jersey Nets being a team when I lived there. But, you know, I think you tend to kind of gravitate who's good. And the Knicks had a great team in the 90s and very identifiable, and were in some historic series. But the Knicks, you know, it's been a rough 20 years since then. more downs than ups, but I think that's the beauty of fandom, is that you just kind of, you know, you weather the storm, and it's not about just following them when they're doing great. You know, you kind of always pay attention. This year was a little disappointing. I didn't really like the team play, especially Julius Randle. I'm not really a big fan of his game, so I halfway through the season I kind of started not watching as much.
You know, so when you talk to like people who are non-sports fans, like friends who are non-sports fans, like how do you relate it to them? Or it's funny because it's like if I geek out about movies, like you'll talk to certain people about things and their eyes can just glaze over. Like if you're trying to get people to talk about basketball who aren't fans, how do you approach that? I'm always curious. Because you should be very passionate about it when you do.
I don't. I mean, I'd say the only environment that I would talk to someone about it who's not interested is Twitter. And if they don't like it, then they can just unfollow me, I guess. So, because I'm sure my feed might look a little random because I'll, you know, talk about music or I'm doing this or I got this show or this tour. Or here's this guitar thing, and then for a couple hours in the evening, I'll just start naming random players. I'm sure some people are like, "What is he talking about?" I don't get it, but that's all right. I mean, we're all you know, I think fairly versatile. Whether it's you know, a big football game going on and you'll see people talking about that, or, you know, the Olympics or whatever, boxing and UFC is obviously pretty big on Twitter. So, you know, even I think we're all kind of okay with the idea that there are these events going on and we're going to be involved in. And that's honestly one of the best things about Twitter is live events and people kind of real time commenting and having this kind of global conversation. It's really fun.
As opposed to all the vitriol that keeps going, keeps getting
spewed. Well, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I'm saying like,
it's nice. It's nice to hear that side of it.
What's that?
It's nice to hear that side of it.
Yeah, but I think it goes with anything. You know, like people live tweeting the Oscars or anything like that, or, you know, it's like we're never gonna forget that night. You know, that Will Smith slapped Chris Rock from a Twitter perspective. And
oh, the memes are endless now. Oh my God! Memes, you know, it's
these. You know, despite it being an unfortunate event, from a Twitter perspective, it's what makes Twitter great, in my opinion.
It just goes on and on. Yeah, I probably spend some days. I'm like, keep looking on things. I'm like, I learn a lot, and sometimes it's just too much information. You know, social media. I imagine for sports, it's like that too, because you can have an endless deluge of tweets going through all this.
It's beyond just the tweets. It's essentially, you know, going back to the 90s, once the 24-hour news cycle started, you know, and you have a million TV stations and radio stations and podcasts and all these YouTube channels where they need content constantly. So they just talk about a lot of bullshit because they have to talk about something. And so it's a lot of making mountains out of molehills and delving into drama that doesn't really exist, and I get it. You have to kind of feed the fire a little bit, but it also, a lot of it is very frivolous, and so you have to kind of know when to not take the bait, I think, because it, you know, definitely kind of devolves into something that's not very intellectually coherent often.
Exactly. So when you played basketball, when you were playing basketball more actively, in high school, what positions did you play? Was there any one thing you were better at, stronger at than others?
I mean, I pretty much played anything from shooting guard to power forward, you know, but I preferred to be in that, like, small forward shooting guard position. You know, we had a pretty big team when I was a senior, but then a couple guys quit, so that I went from being the shooting guard to the to the power forward. So you're kind of banging a little bit. The team's not as big, not as long, makes defending a lot harder. But you know, more likely, you know, for high school, I'm probably like a small forward, probably the best role, because I wasn't the best ball handler, you know. So I don't know if my guard skills are probably the most competent. If I'm playing pickup, usually I'm one of the bigger guys playing, you know, because it ain't the NBA where the average height is 6'7". So, you know, in the grand scheme of the populace, I think 6'2" puts you in like the 1% or 2 or 3% of height for men, I believe.
Yeah, well, that's good. It works for basketball. It's true. The guy from Africa, Manute Bol, was that his name? The guy from Africa who was like, what, he was like 7?
I think 7'5".
How long did he actually play for? I'm trying to remember.
I can't remember. I want to say, you know, like 9 or 10 years probably.
That was a long time. Yeah. I remember it was sort of he was a novelty at the beginning, and I'm like, oh, he can play. You know, he kind of.
Yeah, I mean, he was the truth is, I mean, there's these diminishing returns with height that once you kind of get above 7'3", the kind of human body has difficulty with the running and coordination, and then you have physical ailments, whether it's knee stuff or foot stuff. There's always kind of an issue, and mobility, you know. So you can have a guy who's really tall who can block shots, but you know, if you can't stay in front of anybody, if you can't get up the floor, then you become kind of a liability. But some of them, you know, have done really well. The guy Boban, who I think is 7'4" or 7'5", is really good. He's actually a really good player and can be really useful. So it's, you know, and then Yao Ming, who I think was 7'4" or 7'5", was actually really good. But you know, his ailments kind of forced him to retire way early. But he was really good when he did play.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it's like to be that tall. Yeah. I'm 5'10", so I'm like right serving the average, I think, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know what? I think what it is it's probably really shitty 90% of the time when you're not playing basketball, because the world isn't made for someone of your height, you know? And then you literally have to make a bunch of money to be able to, like, you know, have a car that fits you and have a house that, you know, meets kind of something where you're comfortable, because it's a average height person's world. So I imagine it's really uncomfortable. And unlike, especially if you're famous, right? If you're 6'11" and you're Kevin Durant or something, you can't just put on a hoodie and have people not know who you are. You literally are a foot taller than everyone around you, and you stick out like a sore thumb. So it must be a lot harder being famous as well when you're really tall.
Yeah. So, like, what do you like at a game? Are you one of those really passionate fans that yells a lot, or you kind of just take it in? Or
Nah. I'm pretty chill. You know, I get into it. You know, I mean, probably no different than when I'm at home, which is just, you know, do a lot of God damn, like wop or like wop up, or like God, you know, I'm kind of, you know, or I was like, man, what are you doing? I'll kind of be talking to them like as if they can hear me. You know, it's pretty.
That's like when you watch Jeopardy.
I'm definitely engaged. What's that?
It's like when you watch Jeopardy, I could have gotten that question. But then the thing is, you don't think about the fact that you're not sitting there on TV in front of a bunch of people doing something. The mentality is very different than when you're an armchair.
Oh, like, trust me. No. I never have the perspective that I can do better than anyone else there. You know, and keep in mind, you're also, and this is, you know, kind of the fallacy of vantage point is like, yeah, you have this bird's eye view where you can see everything going on, but if you're on the floor, you're seeing, you know, you're only seeing things at these certain angles. So something that might be obvious to someone on TV is not obvious to someone in the game, especially when it's moving at such a lightning fast pace, you know?
Yeah. What was your favorite personal moment playing basketball?
So when I was a junior, I started the year as a on JV, and I played so well they brought me into the varsity squad, and I didn't get a ton of playing time, but it was a playoff game. It was our first playoff game, and I ended up hitting 2 3-pointers in overtime to basically put us ahead. I actually hit a go-ahead shot.
Nice.
I hit back-to-back three-pointers. And then the other team came down, like, and hit a layup, like, easily. And I was like, good Lord, we lost the lead. And then we inbounded the ball, and our point guard took a half-court shot and hit it, and won the game. It was like a storybook. But that wouldn't have happened if I didn't hit those two three-pointers to kind of get there. And then, actually, when I was a senior, I broke the record, the three-point record for a game, which was 7. At the time, I'm sure now someone's probably hit 15 because they have a really good – we were a really shitty team, and now they're like one of the top teams in the country. It was a prep school, and they started recruiting. So I'm sure someone's hit a lot of three-pointers now. But at the time, I had broken the record.
Fabulous. Yeah, I don't really have a – I think Little League was never like I had – I think there was one moment that I always liked was a friend of mine was making fun of the fact that I got picked to be a pitcher. And then when he got up there, I struck him out. So that was a good moment of redemption. Didn't even swing. He was just struck out. That's about it.
It happens.
It does. So, like, you know, and it's interesting, you know, you love sports and you love music. And another thing we wanted to talk about, obviously, is you do like to comment on social and political issues, which these days is it's a trickier thing than it was for the bands that we were growing up with. And I guess the only way these kind of cross over is the taking a knee at various games. I know that happened in basketball also. It wasn't just football. Seems like, and I think the Milwaukee Bucks, didn't they, at least one of the teams to stop playing? At least a couple
of games,
right? Yeah,
that's when there was the incident in Wisconsin.
My best friend lives in Wisconsin, yeah.
They kind of protested that. I think it was just one game, though. You know, the players decided to do that, and that was kind of at the peak of, you know, that protest movement happening in 2020. You know, it's funny because I do enjoy talking about these things, but I've definitely gotten, I think, more distant from that in the last few years. I feel like the tenor of the discourse kind of during the Trump era leading into 2020 and that election and everything around it, like, and also, you know, there's a lot of acrimony within our band and issues with that made the kind of playing field a lot more treacherous, you know? And so, and part of that is kind of making a decision to go, okay, in this environment, you can go, okay, I'm going to be a political person, and that's going to be who I am, and that's how I'm going to express myself, or I'm going to be a musician. And I think you have to, at some point, make a decision about who you are and what you want to be. If you want to be an activist, go do that. But don't think people are going to necessarily take you as seriously, I think, as a musician when you're spending all your time. You only have so many kind of eggs to put in each basket, you know. So, I really decided to, like, focus on making my content mostly derived from what I'm working on creatively, whether that's music or the podcast or things like that. And then pepper in social commentary where I feel like it's necessary, but I don't want to, because I have friends of mine who are musicians who it's like 90% of what they do is talk about politics, and it kind of drives me crazy where I'm like, dude, just can you give it a break? Can you take a day off? Take a minute? It's like, you know, and a news event can happen that you don't have to comment on. It's okay. The world will survive without your take, you know? And so I kind of think about that with myself, is not wanting to be just like beating people over the head with that stuff and having kind of being able to exhale. And so I kind of balance that with talking about movies and things that are funny and entertaining things and also uplifting things and trying to populate my feed with things that are not just, here's what I hate about blank, you know, which is like, you know, it can just be insufferable.
Well, it's tricky. Like, if you're Bono and U2, it's one thing, because there's always been kind of like a lot of social issues that come up in their music. What's interesting about the metal world is back in the 80s, I felt like a lot of the thrash bands, for example, they were kind of railing against the powers that be, no matter who they were. You know, they would be criticized Reagan, they criticize, you know, Gorbachev or whoever else. Like, it wasn't simply about it was sort of like challenging the powers that be, like, you're not representing us. And we had, of course, we had the threat of nuclear annihilation looming over us, which seems to be coming back. That's one of the 80s, parts of the 80s revival I wished wasn't coming back, was that threat. And I felt almost like post 9/11 is when you started to see a shift. That event really shifted. You started to see a lot more politics coming out about stuff. And then under the Bush administration, and that seems to slowly get, it was kind of growing and growing. And yeah, I think during the Trump era, it definitely hit like this peak, this fever pitch where everything became political. And it's tricky because stuff that seemed to be more about how you felt about people in power became much more about which side of the people in power you're with.
Sure.
Does that make any sense? With metal, it was sort of anti-establishment generally. Real metal, not like the hair bands and this stuff. And it, did you find that shift yourself? Did you notice that yourself? Or was there a period you noticed this all changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this started during the Clinton administration. And a lot of that had to do kind of a correlation between right-wing radio, talk radio, like Rush Limbaugh and things like that getting really popular. You know, you basically had the beginnings of the internet and, you know, people of like-minded ideology being able to find each other and coalesce. Then you have the kind of the uprising of tabloid media, you know, OJ, things like that, watching, you know, people, you know, the Clarence Thomas trials, like that sensationalist type of thing, and the impeachment and Monica Lewinsky thing fed into that very well. And most, it seemed like primarily the opposition of Bill Clinton was less about policy and more about personality and kind of moral points, right? And so it became about, well, if whatever like validity you think that is, that was kind of the real shift. And then also by the end of his administration, Fox News shows up, you know, in being kind of distinctly partisan, even if people, the perception was that the mainstream media was more liberal in general. This was kind of more kind of pronounced and obvious, you know? And so so that partisan framing got kind of rooted in there.
Yeah.
And then 2000 election happens and Florida and all, you know, and that craziness, then 9/11, right? And our conspiracy culture, right? And things like that. So
I think it got bigger after that, didn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
yeah.
But I think from those points, you just get this really slow moving divergent thing where people get stuck in their echo chambers. I think there's this real distinct, I think, point, and it's really, it is post-Obama, where the culture wars seem to just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that was 2008 was like the last time things kind of seemed to be somewhat in the realm of like we could have reasonable conversations about policy, right? Like, oh, I want to vote for this guy because I think he's going to lower taxes, right? Or I think, you know, healthcare, but you know, whatever. It's like these, I remember having like definitive discussions about policy with friends. You know, it wasn't about crazy wedge issues, you know, where now everything is a wedge issue.
It's weird because we have this two-party system that, you know, we get divided and people talk about that. And after a while, you know, you have Democrats. So, I mean, I have neighbors that are more conservative than me and we'll agree on stuff. We might get into a debate and I'll say, hey, see, we agree on a lot of stuff. We might not agree necessarily on how to solve certain issues, but it's clear we agree that there are certain things that are issues. And now it's gotten trickier because I think artists can say I mean, a lot of artists are talking about social issues. I don't think it's just entertainment. And I think certainly athletes have the right to voice their opinion. I think the problem that comes in is, if it gets too heavy-handed, that's a problem. And then number two, though, it can be heavy-handed on the other side where someone says you're not allowed to say whatever you want. But then if you do have the right to free speech, then the other conundrum is you have the right to free speech and you also have the right to be criticized. So it becomes this giant, you know what
well,
I mean?
But I think you just pointed out there, it's not about what you're allowed to say. People don't want to be criticized. They don't. They want to say what they want to say and have no clapback. And they think, oh, I'm not allowed to say it. It's like, no, you can say that. But and I think, obviously, the point to where, you know, and this is kind of the crux of what is perceived as cancel culture is, okay, if person X says this thing, but then a group of people online make moves to get that person fired from their job or, you know, kicked off their record label or things like that. And that mobilization, which, by the way, is also free speech, right? I'm allowed with my speech to go out and try and affect whatever. You know, we used to call it a boycott. You know, it's like, oh, you had such and such on your show, Johnny Carson, and me and this coalition of moms is gonna go. We're gonna go petition Tide and tell not to sponsor your show, right? Like, this is old as anything, right? It's just the people who want to do these things have to have more tools at their disposal. That's the double-sided coin of speech, is that people can use their speech to try and shut down your speech or at least make you feel the pain for having opinions or ideas that they feel are dangerous. But to kind of your other point about you and your neighbors having a conversation, I think the problem now, and this is going back, you know, at this point, you know, 6 or 7 years, is we can't have a conversation about what we disagree on if we can't actually agree on what is real. So if
that's a big problem.
If we don't have a shared reality, then there's basically no conversation. And so you have two divergent far ends of a spectrum who have completely different realities of what they think is happening. And so those people can have no conversation. And then people like me, who's trying to get a fully scoped idea of it and listen to everyone in good faith, we're looked at as the primary enemy, more than even the opposite ends of the spectrum. The centrist is considered to be the worst, you know, actor in all this. That's a tough environment. So if I'm going, you know, oh, COVID isn't real, right? How can we have a conversation about you know, rules or vaccines or anything if you don't even believe it's real? If you, you know, so it's, and you, and I'm just making that as an example.
No, it's a scary thing, isn't it? Because you look at people online, and I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, and a lot of people sit there and they'll criticize millennials and they'll go, I don't know, man, some of the Gen Xers and the younger boomers and the way they were expressing their opinions online was like 15-year-olds. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is what you're actually going to say to somebody. You wouldn't say that in real life, first of all. And secondly, yeah, there is this kind of reality that's been shaped by social media that doesn't really exist. I know people get real. I got a couple people get really angry, and even they were allegedly on my side, because it's just sort of like, I found an interesting tweet. I liked your tweet about the whole Will Smith thing, because you brought that up. You said, "We as a society love justified violence, so I expect a lot of 'he had it coming' takes," which was interesting.
Which exactly really what happened.
Yeah, it wasn't political. It was more of a social commentary, actually. And there is also a difference. You could make that and not be political about it. You're just saying.
Well, I think what happens now is you have a big portion of people, especially on Twitter, who are engaged fully as a combatant in the culture war. And in that culture war, there's these very like definitive, like, I am pro-mask. I am anti-mask. I am pro, right? They have these like, I am pro-Biden, I am anti-Biden, right? And so they have this very binary way of looking at the world. Yeah. And so then they'll try and, to any event, they'll try and affix it to fit this binary that isn't really real, right? Like, and they'll make these takes because a lot of people, these commentators and YouTubers and pundits, their brand is, I'm pro this. I'm with this tribe, I'm against this tribe. So they're going to find a way to contort whatever issue into that. And I'm trying to do the opposite of that and go, hey, some of these things exist completely of their own. They have nothing to do with COVID. This has nothing to do with Trump. It's just this. We're talking about this thing. Let's talk about this thing and have an idea about it. I think moments like that, because a lot of people are like, man, I was so sick of that, everyone talking about it. But I'm like, I think that event was actually worth having those conversations, because these are big questions. When is it okay to use violence in public, right? Because think about it. Mike Tyson just beat up a guy last week, and I pretty much saw no takes of people saying he shouldn't have hit him. Everyone was fine with that, right?
Well, that was the thing. Like, I mean, it's sad that with the war in Ukraine, that's a lot more violence. It needs a lot more attention than the Will Smith thing. But I think what the Oscars thing pointed out, which I think you're talking about now with the Mike Tyson thing, is, you know, we've become very uncivil as a society. And, you know, it was a dumb joke, and I'm sure they knew it was a dumb joke. But then there's a little hypocrisy in the way Will Smith laughed at it first, and then his wife gets mad, so then he goes up. And after a while, it's like, you know, if you were going to go up on stage anyway, my take is, you could just berate him in front of everybody and say, you know what, man, that's not cool. But that's not what he chose to do. And it actually is funny because people talk about liberal Hollywood. Isn't that kind of what an action movie star would do? Like a cliche action movie thing is, instead of saying, let's talk about this like you and I are talking about, I'm just going to hit you. And so I'm like, there was a great quote from Roger Ebert about Hollywood. He goes, you know, the Oscars is the one time a year that Hollywood gets to pat itself on the back for doing these arty pictures. And the rest of the year, they're bringing us Texas Chainsaw 3D. And I was like, that is so true. Like, I worked in Hollywood, and people talk about liberal Hollywood. I don't buy that tag either. I think a lot of the talent might skew more left, but a lot of the money people skew more right.
And well, it's performative liberalism. It's in the idea that it's a group
for a lot of
people,
them, yeah.
I think, well, that it's a group of people that want, you know, their whole thing is that they're likable, and that they're bankable, and so that essentially they'll sway with whatever is the most publicly, I guess, politically correct at that given time, or the thing they think will be most advantageous to that. I think that is often tough to triangulate, right? Always trying to guess who is being genuine and who isn't being genuine. But I imagine behind closed doors, a lot more of those people are probably less liberal, quote unquote. I'm using that in the most kind of vague sense.
A general sense, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, more than they let on, because they're trying to, you know, they're trying to protect their money.
Their brand.
You know?
Well, you know, isn't it the same thing about a lot of these right-wing commentators, though? Because I, excuse me, I feel like I look at someone like Ann Coulter, and sometimes I'm like, does she really buy all this? Or is it just she knows it's going to sell her books, that there's an angry conservative crowd that's going to buy her books? So if she just says that, it doesn't matter if she fully believes it or not. That's also her way of making money. So there's a lot of things on both sides where you can go, I don't know, man. This is just theater.
Well, but that's different, though. And here's the reason why. Because I think unless it's someone like, I don't know, like Mark Ruffalo, who's like pretty outspoken about it.
Oh, sure.
I don't think it's necessarily fair to compare someone who's just like an actor who's just trying to make their way and not ruffle feathers as someone who their job is being a political commentator. And to me, there's a distinct difference on the left and right, because I think the performative element of the political commentator on the right is more comparable to what's called kayfabe in wrestling, which is essentially the idea that when the camera's on, you're in character, and Ann Coulter is a heel. Her character is that she says outrageous things that pisses liberals off, and throws red meat to the people that want that mean girl take. And her being tall and skinny and blonde gives her a license to be that much more cutthroat with her opinions, right?
And so, but isn't like that acting also, though?
Oh no, absolutely. And she plays up to it. She's good at her job as the heel, and it works. But they're giving their audience what they want, and some people will call it a grift, right? It's a grift. I'm like, is it a grift if the people consuming it are happy with the product and they're happy to give you their money when you buy a book and go see you at the speaking tour and subscribe to your Patreon or whatever. So it's a mutually beneficial system. Again, it's
that
tough.
It speaks to your echo chamber thing, though. It speaks to what you were talking about with echo chambers, because it kind of goes back to that, right? They're consuming the reality that they want.
Well, it's political comfort food, and I think I'm guilty of that sometimes, right? I think to be challenged is work. It's mental work. It's sometimes you know, and I had this period, you know, when I would, and I, you know, I stopped listening to Joe Rogan. It's not like I won't ever listen to Joe Rogan again. I'll hopefully go back because I still think he's great at what he does. But when he got so much into, I feel like every time he's talking about vaccines, he's talking about this. I'm just like, dude, just, and when I hear things that are just not accurate and not researched, and then there's someone else there not challenging it and no one's challenging it, it's like, it's almost stressful. Yeah. To go like, this is, I'm like, and I listen, I'm like, 10 million people right now are listening to bullshit, and they probably believe it because they trust these people. And that, and so when you, and so it's like this thing of like, A, like, I follow tons of people on Twitter that I disagree with. But it's really important to me that I understand their perspective. Even if, you know, it's because I don't want to be in an echo chamber. It's really important to me to not do that.
It's critical thinking, which is, you know, I think that that's the term that gets tossed around. I mean, I think the problem is not being taught that early. Part of it's also education. I remember when I was at NYU, I took a class. It was an English class that was taught by a graduate law student. I think her name was Mary Dietz. And she was, I always remembered her because she did challenge us. And I remember once we had to read stories, and we had to read and discuss the subtext. And there was a story about a woman who had assaulted this guy on a train station. Because he had allegedly been, you know, like, you know, being inappropriate with her. And what was interesting is I read the story, and it was written by a man, and it very clearly made it seem like she was the aggressor in this situation. It's like she was misinterpreting something, and he was the passive thing in this. I'm like, I don't know, man. Living in New York at that time in the late 80s, I could totally see some women getting really tired of these assholes out there. And sure. I felt the story probably was really slanted in a way that didn't make sense. That if you read between the lines, you know, I think this guy probably was said, really, maybe she's nuts, or really he had pissed her off and she got tired of it and she fought back, you know. And you have to read, sometimes you have to look at the source, and sometimes you have to look at how it's worded. And I can't stand nightly news, because no matter what it is, it's always the dramatic music and they're trying to get you tense, and you'll watch it. At the end of it, you're like, oh. Whereas like if you and I go onto different sites and check out, like, thehill.com is interesting because they're kind of a centrist website, actually. People think they're on the right, but I actually really consider them to be centrist. They're really kind of in the middle. A lot of it is just straight-up reporting, and you can see in the comments who's on what side, but they try not to sensationalize it, which I think is important. Well, and that we've gotten – news was a loss leader when you and I were growing up. Now it's a moneymaker, and that's the big problem here.
Yeah. Well, and was that law that they changed, the fairness doctrine – that, you know, that's a big change in the news media. But I think it's really important to point this out, that the way different news sources are biased is not necessarily how they report something, because a lot of that is just editorializing, right? Like, so you go on Sean Hannity and it's like, oh, he's giving his opinion about a news story, but he's not doing the actual reporting. It's essentially selection, right? So, you know, Huffington Post, they're just going to cover the stories that help their narrative and disregard the stories that don't. So they're not lying, but they're just not showing the full picture. So I actually am subscribed to this website called Blindspot, and it shows you, it's a newsletter, and it's also a website, but it shows you, here are the stories that the left was not shown. Here are the stories the right was not shown, because those Breitbart chooses to show, oh, here's a black dude who did some crime, because that's the story they want to tell. Here's, you know, here's a story about Nazis in Ukraine, because that's the story we want to tell. And then if you're going to MSNBC.com, they're going to, you know, here's the Trump kids law they broke, right? It's so. All that stuff is happening, but it's just saying, well, we're going to cover the things that we feel is moving our agenda, but it's not lying. It's just selection, you know? And so
that's where a lot of the arguments come in. And I mean, like, you know, even though I'm more of a liberal, like, there is some super woke stuff that drives me crazy, because it's like every little thing becomes offensive to people. And like, you cannot be offended by everything. And you don't start a fight with your grandparents, because it's probably not going to change anything. Like, unless they're really oppressing your life, they're just sitting there watching TV, doing whatever. I just don't think that's an argument worth having, in all honesty. Yeah. Like, if you have a parent you have a problem with, or what, you know what I mean? Like, it's figuring out who you really need to be talking to, I guess, and having these conversations with, rather than just letting it out on everybody, whether you're on the left, right, center, whatever it is. Usually it's more on the polls, right?
Yeah, well, it's really important to remember is things like your mindset about that is a very, very mainstream mindset. There's a, you know, we're talking 10 to 12% of Americans are what would people describe as far left or like leftist or like the woke kind of, or, you know, you know, kind of sect. That group is very, very loud on in social media spaces. And then, they're also overly represented in tech, at universities, in all these different areas that have in media that have a big influence. So they have a big megaphone, but they don't represent most of Americans. And it also skews very young. So if you're above a certain age, then you even if you're left of center, you'll have a much different take on this. And so it's, I think a lot of people have to remember that the quote unquote woke mob or this group of people, there's not as many of them as people think they are. They just have a big voice on the internet, and that most people understand that a lot of this stuff is overblown, and you know, just because you say things are different now, it's like no, you actually, people have to take time to evolve. Like it's just not gonna happen over just because you have a new word that you think we need to use. Doesn't mean everyone's going to adopt it overnight. Like things have to simmer,
it takes time. It changes. It's hard if you want change. I understand that it can be very, very people in your. When I was younger, I was like that. You get very impatient for wanting change. At the same time, like, you know, I hear people complaining.
No patience
about,
well, now.
Patience. Gen Z, and what?
Gen Z has no. By the way, and no. I'm sure no young generation at the time they were young had patience for the things they were living through. Right. But that lack of patience does not mean you can necessarily change the world. Like if you're, they did a lot of protests against Vietnam, thousands, right? Over many years. And not one of those fucking protests stopped the Vietnam War. Not one, you know? So being fed up with something and wanting to change it is not, those things are not always commensurate with each other, you know?
But I think it would have been like wars. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you could be someone who is fed up with slavery in the 1700s. And guess what? You still had to live to be 273 years old to survive the end of slavery. Like, being fed up with something and thinking that you have the ability to change it isn't, you know. And by the way, that person was right. You could still be 100% right that an institution or way of things is totally wrong and you want to change. But it's like, but you can't change everybody and you can't do it overnight. And sometimes, you know, but I think there's a lack of acceptance. I think we live in a world where people have so much agency over cultivating their environment. Oh, I'm only going to watch these shows and I'm only going to hang with these people. And if you say something wrong to me, I'm going to block you. And they think they can cultivate the world. You can't. You know, you kind of have to live somewhat in something where you're not going to like everything all the time.
So when you're not on stage and podcasting, what is Doc Coyle any different?
I don't think so. I'm pretty, transparent about, you know, just my regularness. I try and really amplify that, like, kind of trying to show people how cool I'm not. You know? No, I mean, like, whatever. Like, you know, posting a picture that's maybe not the most flattering or, you know, making a meme out of yourself. And, you know, and by the way, and that's a little tough because I think from an industry standpoint, there's probably a lot of people who manage the band or the label where they want you to project the image of the flawless rock star whose life is amazing and you're always killing it and there's never any problems. And I've a lot of difficulty around that lack of authenticity. You know, I think, you know, I do a lot of really cool things and I have a really cool life and I have access to a lot of environments and people and stuff that's, I don't have to be inauthentic to show how cool it is, you know, but at the same time,
don't let that get to your head. As they say.
Exactly. Well, listen, it's quite a balance, you know, but you know, all the people I know in this industry who have had vastly more success than me, can keep themselves level-headed, then so can I, right? Like, you want to follow those people and pay attention to those people, who do understand that all this stuff, even when you're kicking ass and everyone's, you know, giving you all the love, that's all temporary. But it's all about, you know, for me, it's just about what I'm doing at the moment and not getting wrapped up in, you know, the glory, I guess, you know, like that's not what it's about. It's not about, look how cool I am, give me attention, tell me how great, you know, kind of sitting in that. It's about, you do something cool, you know, whether it's making a record or a song or a cool podcast or an article or whatever, and getting, of course, we're all somewhat addicted to that validation, but it's all about, okay, that's cool, I did something cool, now what's the next thing? And then you keep moving, and so I just get in the mindset of never getting satisfied with any one thing, because I think you're always motivated, like, oh, you write a cool song, well, got to write another one. Yeah, I make a great guitar solo, well, let's make another great guitar solo, and just keep it moving and keep growing and not getting wrapped up in that, you know. But I don't know, you know, I want to keep moving up and getting bigger and doing cool things and doing rock star shit. It's fun.
Well, listen, thank you very much. It was kind of an epic chat.
Hell yeah. You know? I had a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for listening. Please join me for the next episode featuring Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.